Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight, returning, are Judith Yeros Lee, Distinguished Professor Emerita of Communication Studies at Ohio University, and John Bird, Emeritus Professor of English at Winthrop University. And together, they have edited a massive and interesting and entertaining volume called Seeing Mad, Essays on Mad Magazine's Humor and Legacy. And we're continuing our conversation about that book. Judith and John, welcome back to the show. It's such a pleasure to be talking to you about this book. Judith, you were just mentioning off mic that you got a fan letter from Sweden from somebody who hasn't even read the book yet.
I know. I was so surprised. It came in with a headline. It was an email. Thank you for recognizing the importance of Mad Magazine. And he came across, this is an American-born Swede, somebody who's been living in Sweden for quite a long time, who said he had been trolling YouTube looking for things having to do with Mad Magazine and came upon one of the video interviews John and I had done.
You know, this brings up an interesting question, John and Judith. I don't even know if either of you can answer this, but how did the magazine do abroad?
It did very well, and they had different versions in different countries. Judith might know more about that.
Well, I just find it so weird because it's so dependent upon the English language.
Well, there were two different kinds of international editions. One was, of course, just the American issue available internationally.
Right, right.
But the other was a kind of hybrid that included some translated material, but then also a lot of local or indigenous material in the national language. And that was as recent as 2018. I was in Germany teaching in the former East Germany in Halle. And I presented as part of my teaching two different movie parodies from MAD. And the students had never heard of MAD, and they were very interested in MAD. And they told me, oh, you can get MAD magazine at the train station. But by the time I got to the train station the next day, it was gone. And so I was unable to get a copy of the German edition until I got to Nuremberg a few days later.
You know, so it's interesting.
It's all over the country. And about a year ago, somebody who learned about our book interviewed me, and he was writing an article about MAD in a German periodical published in the United States. It was a bilingual periodical, and the issue turned out to be all about MAD, partly in German, partly in English. It was for a Jewish German audience. So, I mean, it's just really interesting the degree to which MAD had an international presence.
It's funny because just this past weekend, I was watching on TCM A Hard Day's Night, obviously about the Beatles, and there's a scene in there where he's reading the paperback version of Son of Mad.
Right.
And it's really prominently featured. And so you got to realize, you know, it just struck me that here's the Beatles who were the thing that was happening, and Mad was like featured in that movie.
Well, yeah, the Beatles loved Mad. There's a really famous early a parody of a Breck shampoo ad with
it has
Ringo.
I think it was
on a near a back cover, but
I think it was the back cover because it was in full color.
Yeah, it was in color.
There was, when I was doing research on comics in the British Library a few years ago, I was looking at parallels to MAD, and there were a number of MAD spin-off competitors, one of which was called Crazy.
That
was a definite effort to capitalize on the spirit of MAD.
Well, you talk about that in one of the essays in the book. There were a number of magazines that popped up in the early days of Mad, which were obviously direct competitors. But did any of them ever actually gain any traction?
I think Cracked had a
Cracked is
a
still around, I think, isn't it?
I don't even know. I think it did relatively well, but Mad certainly eclipsed it.
There's a new effort at this being spearheaded by Bill Morrison, who was the former editor of Mad briefly from 2017 to 2019 when the magazine moved from New York to Burbank. And he and some of the Mad cartoonists are now working on a potential magazine to come out this fall, possibly, in the spirit of Mad. And there's another one whose name escapes me right now that is already a kind of fanzine online. And it's at the end of this new article by Jake. It's an article on Johnny Sampson, who has been doing the fold-ins for Mad since Al Jaffe retired. And at the end of this article in the Chicago Reader by Jake Alter, I can't remember the last name of. Do you remember the name of that?
No. I count on you for memory.
Okay.
He's spending too much time in his man cave.
The Chicago Reader and people who are interested in seeing the sons of Mad in their contemporary iterations can find that article.
Well, this brings up something that I wanted to do in this episode that we didn't do well, I think, complete enough, and that is to trace the entire arc of Mad from its beginning to when it was really, really popular, and then what caused its demise. It started out as a comic, and I can remember the comic incredibly. The story is sort of wrapped up in the demise of EC Comics, right?
It is. Well, the story of the comic book is not figured in the demise of EC Comics. It's figured in the financial need of Harvey Kurtzman, who was apparently so conscientious in the research for the war comics that he was doing for EC Comics that he just couldn't make enough money. And so he and Bill Gaines hatched a plan for a project that would not require him, you know, for a title that would not require him to do any research. And so it was born of the fact that Kurtzman had an incredible sense of humor, and he wrote most, if not all, of the parodies of comics in the first 23 issues, which were all the comic book. And there was enough of a stable of artists already working for EC that finding people to realize his stories was not difficult.
I know, and then were some of the greatest artists in comics were working for EC at that point, but they ran afoul of the comics code.
They did.
Right.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I was going to say, just to make sure that we pin down some dates, it was 1952 was the first issue. October, November was number one. And at that time, it was a comic book, and it would have several features that were usually, they were parodies of other things in comic books or on TV shows, other radio, other things like that. When the comics code came out, I'm using the very, very helpful Mad timeline.
That's right.
1952 to 2020 by Leah, say her last name, Leah Salai, who was one of Judith's research assistants and Judith. It's a really excellent resource near the back of the book. It pulls together the history of Mad in a way that it would be very hard. I don't know that you could find it really anywhere else in this kind of detail.
So when did it switch over to a magazine?
With issue number 24.
Now that must have been a huge gamble, because first of all, it's a magazine that carries no real ads.
Well, in those days it did have ads.
Yeah, it did. The very first.
It did have ads. Like other comic books, it had ads.
Okay.
For Charles Atlas, other comics,
and for that those glasses, the X-ray glasses.
X-ray specs.
I bought those, and I wasn't able to see through women's dresses. I was very disappointed.
I know. And sea monkeys.
So this is 1955.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
because at first it was not a monthly periodical, and even then it was coming out still every so many months. So issue 24 came out in July of 1955, and issue 25. Came out in September, and that switch was twofold. I mean, Bill Gaines had testified before the Kefauver Commission,
right?
That ultimately led to the Comics Code as part of the. It was a commission on juvenile delinquency, and it was really tied up in something that readers today would recognize right away, which is that Kefauver wanted to be president and thought he could use his Senate position to accomplish that visibility. But Gaines testified willingly, and he tried to make the case that every genre has its own aesthetic, and that the blood and gore and humor comics was part of that aesthetic. And there could be good taste in humor comics as well as, and that really he saw censorship as comics as a kind of slippery slope. And when there was this effort at self-censorship by the Comics Publishers Association, Gaines really wanted them to band together to fight this. Mm-hmm. And most of the other publishers were not willing. And so his unwillingness to put the seal of approval on the comic book, of the Comics Code seal of approval, meant that distributors would not handle his product.
Huh.
So he just could not get any sales. He tried for a while and then just gave up. And so that was the, at the same time then, Kurtzman saw this other opportunity to morph the magazine from parodying just comics to offering a wider range of both targets and features. I was going to say they started branching out beyond parodying just comics, although everything was in the comic narrative form, the graphic narrative form.
Yep.
Although there was one set of stories, kind of Cold War stories that were in prose. They were stuck in the middle. But he was parodying. There was one on King Kong called King Pong.
Yep,
and then,
yep.
And there were, of course, there was one of my favorites, the parody of a senatorial investigations and committees, just like the one that held up Gaines, called What's My Shine, which just basically said, government on TV is like a game show, and was a wonderful send-up of the McCarthy hearings. So they were already branching out and experimenting because the original germ of an idea was just really, it quickly burst the seams of what was possible. They saw many, many more things that could be parodied in this graphic narrative form. And so then the magazine was really quite a hit, and that continued for a while and might have continued longer, but Kurtzman really wanted something that had a little more status and a lot more money. He wanted a stake bigger in the magazine, bigger than Gaines was willing to give him. And so he left. And that was really a crisis. It was a crisis for Gaines. Was it
a crisis because of the sort of ideological things that the Kurtzman stood for?
Well, at that point, Mad was really the only title Gaines had that was left in his empire. I mean, I think there may have been a few more Bible comics and educational comics that were limping along, But, I mean, Mad was basically the moneymaker. And so when all the other titles went away. So he needed to keep it going. And there was a very big stable of people. And he gave the reins to Al Feldstein, who turned out to be an outstanding and really visionary editor.
Yeah, and I would say that part of the reason that it was a crisis was because Kurtzman had been so instrumental in the whole spirit of MAD and the contents of what MAD was doing that it must have been a really scary moment for Gaines to lose the person who was really the animating spirit behind MAD. But as Judith said, Al Feldstein was more than capable. I think we should go back, too, because I'm not sure people know their history about the 50s, but the reason for the Comics Code was an outcry in the 50s against juvenile delinquency.
And right.
It was a really influential book by Frederick Wortham, Seduction of the Innocent. He was a psychiatrist, and he's saying that the comics were causing juvenile delinquency, homosexuality, all sorts of problems.
Right. He was insinuating, or actually he was just coming out and saying it, that like there was all sorts of things between Batman and Robin, for
Batman
instance.
And Robin, yes.
Yep.
Superman and Jimmy Olsen.
That's right.
And people who are younger than we are would maybe think about the censorship of music that came up in the 80s.
That's right. That's right.
And with Tipper Gore and Anita Bryant and a few.
Well, there's tremendous fear of rock and roll as
right.
being music for black audiences.
And the labeling right. and the labeling of video games. I mean, one can
yep.
really generalize and say every time there's a new
right.
A new medium that is taken up by young people. The older generation comes in and looks for
It's really funny vis-a-vis MAD, because there really was a JD panic, juvenile delinquent panic, in the
right.
50s, and I can remember it. And there were all these movies, we would call them after school specials about JDs. But MAD was really, it's funny, your parents associated people who read MAD with being JDs.
Well,
right. When I mentioned to my parents that I had discovered MAD in my cousin's basement, they said, "Oh, you can't read that." That was their immediate reaction. So my brother Jimmy and I immediately got a subscription at 10 years old.
My parents were pretty far left, and so they were just amused.
So we get to the peak of MAD. What would you call the peak period of MAD and its influence? 60s and the 70s?
60s to 70s certainly for circulation. I think the peak of circulation, Judith, was 74. Is that correct?
I don't
we
know.
We can look
yeah,
at the timeline,
I
but I go with your memory. Yeah, it did. In circulation data for 74, an all-time high paid circulation of 2.4 million. It was, of course, read by many more people than that. Because
right. You pass on copies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's passed
on. And in 1980-something, the Poopside Down adventure parody, that was the single most high-selling issue ever.
Now, I want to talk about its demise and the causes of its demise. One of the things that you bring up in the essay in the book is, first of all, when this kind of satire starts coming out on television. So you're talking about The Simpsons, The Daily Show, Saturday Night Live actually is the earliest one there. That when you start seeing that kind of parody on television, all of a sudden, the magazine doesn't look so strong. But I would also argue, what do you think about National Lampoon as being a competitor for MAD?
Well, it certainly was. And I think what happened with a lot of readers is that they graduated from MAD to National Lampoon, probably held on to both. But
right.
National Lampoon was even edgier. It was more sophisticated and more juvenile in many ways. But I'm thinking about the famous cover where they had a dog on the cover.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't buy this magazine, we'll shoot this dog. And then they had the Play Dead parody where they had Hoss Cartwright. I can't remember much about it. I wasn't really that much of a reader of National Lampoon. I would read somebody else's copy, but
I can tell you they actually dissed Mad on one of their covers. They had the Mad artist that was most associated with painting of Alfred E. Newman, who was
Mingo.
No. Kelly Frias.
Oh.
Yeah.
And they had him as William Calley from the My Lai Massacre. And the cover said, "What My Lai?" And first of all, that was hard-edged and really tense satire. At the same time, it was dissing Matt as being sort of like for younger audiences.
Well, that's what I was going to add, which is that Mad really targeted an audience, and because of its comic book aesthetic, an audience of kids and high school students. But National Lampoon was more of a college student
type
audience. So I think people could graduate, as John suggested, from one to the other, and people who were really loyal would read both. But in that sense, while they had a similar kind of sensibility, they really targeted different audiences. And I would say further that National Lampoon was far more invested in photography and a different kind of art than Mad, which really was committed to graphic narration.
And although they did a lot of comics, they also did a lot of print pieces too.
They did.
So what's happening to Mad now in the 90s and going into the next century?
All magazines were faced a crisis in the 90s. I mean, the same problems that were confronting Mad, declining newsstand sales, declining subscription sales, advertising problems, which of course was not so much an issue for Mad, though it became it certainly was a sense of revenue problems.
Right.
These were industry-wide concerns. One of the things I found that was really fascinating when I was looking at Mad in the 90s was how much parallel reportage there was about the crisis facing Mad in the 90s and the crisis facing The New Yorker in the 90s.
Right.
When it went through a whole series of editors in a very short amount of time.
Was that true at Mad, too, that it went through several editors?
Not in that day. No.
Okay.
Mad has had a very stable editorial history. I mean, it's had basically five editors. And now it has no editor. It has a managing editor.
But they've also had artists some of them have stuck with them for decades.
Well, yes. That's a function of a couple of things. I mean, one is, and that's true of The New Yorker, too, if you think about it.
Yeah.
The New Yorker works on a contract basis. But Mad had a history of assigning artists a new piece as soon as they delivered the old one. And the idea was to create a kind of visual continuity and paying the artist very well so that Mad had an option, always had a stable that they came to call the usual gang of idiots. So that kind of stability for a freelancer to know that every time you turn something in, you were going to get another assignment, that's a very attractive proposition.
Yeah, it is.
And that was similar to The New Yorker, which put some artists on contract but also had a weekly opportunity for freelancers to submit their work and have it chosen.
And thinking about people who were longtime contributors, we should mention the recent passing of Frank Jacobs.
That's right.
He was the poet laureate of Mad, and he appeared over 300 times. And there are any number of artists and writers who had really, really long careers with Mad. Don Martin, Dave Berg.
Don Martin's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
The best sound effects in comicdom go to Don Martin.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, and there's a great essay in your collection about Spy versus Spy.
Yeah.
And I always First of all, that's a very weird and unique comic. We're going to run out of time. We don't have time to talk about it. But the artist was a really interesting story, and I strongly recommend people picking up this book just to read that essay in this. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's a very interesting history that goes back to Cuba, and it involves Castro, and it's a political and very, very interesting. And so, as you say, it's a unique feature, no words, all visual, and a really quirky style, the angular style that he used.
Yeah. I remember when it first came out and looking at it and really sort of being sort of thrown off. Yeah, looked, and it's a strange, there's no sides. I mean, they both just don't like each other, but you never know who's good or bad. They're both bad and good.
Right.
And it's,
at one point there was the third gray spy who was...
that's right, the woman.
Yeah.
It was like the Roadrunner cartoons if there were only coyotes.
Yeah.
I
wanted to mention Antonio Perhias, to mention his
fascinating
name. But it's been continued, and the successor is, who's the successor, Judith?
Peter Cooper.
Yeah, Peter Cooper, yeah.
Who's a great artist. As a matter of fact, he was one of my first guests when I started this show.
Oh, great.
He's a wonderful artist, and he does. He works in a kind of auteur vein, too. He's just published all these graphic renderings of graphic adaptations of Kafka that are just...
I know. I love the maze that he did in that. That's fantastic stuff. We're completely...
Can we talk about the 21st century, Mad? Because
not now, because we're out of time.
Too bad.
let me mention, just to do business... that the University of Missouri Press told us that they had sold out all of their run of Seeing Mad, but now it's out in paperback. So
okay, good.
They've also restored the hardcover, John. I think there are more hardcover copies available too.
They're all distributed.
We're completely out of time, and I haven't got to half the questions I wanted to ask. My guests tonight have been Judith Lee, Distinguished Professor Emerita of Communication Studies at Ohio University, and John Bird, Emeritus Professor of English at Winthrop University. Together, they have edited an amazing collection, Seeing Mad, Essays on Mad Magazine's Humor and Legacy. Judith and John, it's been a pleasure. It's almost like we have to do another show. but Mad's worth it. So thank you so much for your time, guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.